From the beautiful Rainbow Room, high atop St. Pete Athletic in the Warehouse Arts District, we're coming to you with Arts Alive, the St. Pete Catalyst podcast. My name is Bill DeYoung, and guess what? This is podcast number 171. And our guest today is L.L. Kirshner, the famous author, novelist, and memoirist, and she's sitting right here.
Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for having me. I love the new digs.
The new digs. I'm telling you, I'm going to start putting up some paintings from Sears in here and really make it look good. This is Ms. Kirshner's fourth appearance on this podcast, I looked. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You as well, Bill.
Well, it's
hard for us to stop gabbing to start recording, actually.
It took us a few minutes to get there. LL is here today because she's got a new novel out. It's called The Critic, and this is your fourth novel. Yeah, after The Queenpin Chronicles, which we're going to talk about again. You came on here to talk, I think, about each book in succession when those three came out. The Critic. And essentially, folks, I'm gonna give you the really quick synopsis of this. This is a theater critic in the great city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who something happens to him, and there's a great big mystery involved. It's a whodunit and whodunwhat. And there's some main characters who are pretty interesting and some ancillary characters who are pretty interesting, too. It's a police procedural in a way. It's a mystery. It's a whodunit. It's about brownies. give me your elevator pitch about this book.
Gosh, after that, I want to know who your favorite character was. But I will say, The Critic is a psychological suspense.
Dina. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
It's set in 1995 Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and it features rivals at alternative news weeklies. Yeah. And the one critic collapses from ricin poisoning at his desk on the first day, and suspicion immediately falls to his rival, Jessica Greer. She's got to prove herself in the face of a lot of pretty damning evidence. And the biggest problem that she has is that she's not even sure herself.
Yeah, you're giving away the plot here.
Am I?
Yeah, well, there's a lot more to it, folks. But that's essentially
that's
the
pretty
setup.
Much the first. That's pretty much the first and second chapter.
So once you get there, Jessica's an interesting character because I've read your memoirs. I've read a lot of your writing, which is pretty. It's getting better all the time. If I may, and I wondered, Jessica self-questions a lot, and there's her internal monologue is part of the narrative of this book. How much of you is in her?
Well, there's always a lot of me in every character because it's basically I take and I feel like I become each character in the book because I never want to write someone from a cartoonish aspect where they aren't a real person. So I have a lot of backstory for every character. I have a very long history. Seth, you know, her brother.
Yeah. Right.
I have a whole backstory about him and his girlfriend, Yuna. And you would never know it. It doesn't appear on the page. But I had to figure out, okay, if she's a medical student, what's her timeline? I think none of this actually ended up in the book. You don't. You're looking at me like you have no idea what I'm talking about.
Seth sort of has like a cameo.
Not really.
Well, later in the story, he plays a major role.
He plays a major role, for that to feel real to me, I had to develop a whole. I had to figure out, okay, when did he go to school? What would be realistic for that time period, and what could be done? And then, if this is his girlfriend, and then you know the main character, how they're interacting.
All the while knowing you weren't going to use that just for your own
edification? No, I don't know if I'm going to use things or not. And most often, I guess I don't, but I guess I kind of enjoy that too. I mean, I don't chunk out a book a month, so I am not, you know, trying to set any records. But I want to have characters that are very real because they're very vivid to me on the page.
But Jessica, and I say this with all deference and
she's a mess.
Love and respect. There, I mean, from reading your memoirs, which of course are called American Lady Creature and Blissful Thinking, check them out, folks. You know, that same sort of internal monologue was yours. I don't think you were nearly as messed up as Jessica Greer is.
No, and she is the first character that I've done in a novel from first person.
Yeah.
So that I'm glad that came across on the page and it made her feel, because I had originally started her off, you know, with she and Jessica and so forth. But I felt like her character needed a lot of interiority to make sense of her actions because she's very unpredictable. And that's kind of the way she appeared to me on the page.
Well, I've always found you kind of unpredictable.
And so she, when she is at lunch with her editor and he gets the call that her rival has collapsed at his desk, what does she do? She says, I'm coming with you. And that was a surprise to me, for instance. So I needed to have her feel relatable. When somebody is that unpredictable, I think, at least it just struck me as the best way to do justice to her was to put her in first person. And that's what allowed me to go a little deeper with her interiority.
Oh, sure. Well, you bring up an interesting thing in that Jessica is not only a suspect. Agent Cole is another one of my favorites, by the way. Lydia Cole, the...
Love her.
Yeah. She was great. And those characters are narrative. I mean, in the, what do you call the third person, I guess, where you're...
Limited,
Yeah, okay.
Omniscient, whatever.
And so Jessica's the only one that's in first person. But Jessica is not only a suspect... You know, for good reason, as Agent Cole works out, but she's also kind of investigating it too. Her mother was a great character. I mean, I literally just finished the book this morning, so they're all very fresh in my mind. And I was almost late getting here to do this podcast because I was like, okay, what's going to happen? And got there. But that was interesting that she and her mother, and plus some other people that we meet, you know, kind of start to suss it out. Eventually, what's really happened here? You had a launch yesterday, wasn't it, at Pages and Perks?
It was actually at the Velvet Mat, which is a yoga studio in town, a brand new one, Central and Fourth. About, do you remember where the Iberian Rooster used to be?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Back from the True Stories days.
And you're down in that thing, the basement thing?
Well, interestingly, it's in the basement, but it's a different area of the basement.
Ooh.
Right.
Starting to sound very Indiana Jones-ish.
Well, it kind of is, and that's why it was the perfect venue for this. And Pages and Perks is a bookstore that's yet to open. They're going to be opening soon in Roser Park. And I know the owner, Kate Johnson, from my home shopping network days. Funny enough, the owner of the Velvet Mat is also someone I know from my home shopping network days, Crystal Sage. So it's an amazing, for me, homecoming for the book, for this event, and the perfect place to be because the Velvet Mat, again, it's underground. Tara Lush is an author, local author in town.
Sure, yeah.
She interviewed me. She asked some really great questions. But it was also, since the book is set in 1995, we did it as a costume party. And... People came. You wouldn't believe the costumes. We had Spice Girls. We had Monica. We had Rachel. We had Elle from Legally Blonde. You know, across the spectrum, from grungy to very poppy.
When does Pages and Perks open? Do we know?
They're supposed to, let me say, this summer. Is that vague enough? You know, it's always a question of waiting on
permits. That's a fair catalyst term. We'll have to look into that. You got me just now thinking about the fact that it was set in the 90s.
Yeah.
And that you set it at in a world that kind of doesn't exist anymore. I mean, I've been doing this job, not this sitting in front of a microphone, but writing arts and newspapers since the very early 1980s, right? And so I know newsroom culture pretty well. And it was an interesting sort of rediscovery of newsroom culture in a way.
Did it work for you?
It worked, but yeah. Oh, yeah, it worked. But
I was in that very newsroom.
I know you were. I know you were. Okay, but the thing is that nobody really even has theater critics anymore. You know, maybe New York Times, LA, Chicago, whatever.
They're all freelance. Like Jessica was a harbinger of things to come.
Well, okay. The point is that I thought it was just so interesting that you said it there and in that time during that culture.
Oh, it was so important. So I'll tell you,
the internet is just starting to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I find it very interesting, especially considering, you know, a lot of the media narrative now around these ideas of fake news and this unending like maw of content that's constantly coming at you.
It's a maw.
And that was really the dawn of that era. And one of the reasons that I love writing historical fiction, because guess what, Bill? This actually qualifies.
I know. I feel like I'm historical fiction.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, think about it. Like the Clueless reboot that's coming out this summer, it looks to kids today like Grease looked to us when we were kids, right? It, like this costume drama of kind of, wow, I can't believe people used to look like that. And that's what people look when, you know, because if they do it in a genuine way, nobody's going to have Botox and nobody's going to have their teeth done. And they're going to think, what's going on with those people?
But it was interesting to revisit the 90s newsroom culture.
Well, and the reason that I thought it was so interesting is because there was a lot of actual FBI investigation into terrorist acts going on. And certainly mailing poison through the U.S. mail was considered a terrorist act. And you mentioned Agent Cole. Lydia Cole, I have a whole backstory for her that didn't make it in there.
Why am I not surprised?
Where her mother was a newspaper reporter. At one time, like in her youth. And so she had some familiarity with how sort of the newsrooms worked. And she was slightly more interested in it than her colleagues would have been. And when she heard the news, she immediately gleaned that this was probably a local situation and not something that was going to require a national team. And she saw it as an opportunity to get herself in there and be the lead detective investigator on the case. And that was also a fun thing because, you know, everything old is new again, right? So what was happening at the dawn of the internet? Everybody thought it was sort of the end of – people were just not have any brains anymore. It was the end of an era, you know, and all this stuff.
I think it might be true.
It's a lot like AI, right? The sort of fear-mongering around AI.
Yeah.
Although I will say, you know, I'm not a huge fan of it for many things. But that's a sort of different topic. I like to go back to those source moments. So what was the source moment here? You have these women – and they're getting branded. You've got the Ice Queen with Tanya Harding and, oh my gosh, I can't even remember the other. Nancy Kerrigan.
Nancy Kerrigan.
And then, you know, you have. But women, the Long Island Lolita. You have all of these people. The women are sexualized when they are turned into villains. And then you have men and you've got Night Stalker, the Zodiac Killer. And they sound, you know, kind of elevated. Like they are more scary, whereas women, they're scary because they're sexy.
What does the TV news call her? The
male murderess.
The male murderess.
I leaned into it. Right. Yeah. I leaned into it to a certain extent. And frankly, I did try to think of sort of like the something that would sexualize her in some way. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, Ted Harvey, he's not straight. She does end up with another poison package in her orbit.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, they gave her that nickname pretty quickly because suspicion fell on her very quickly.
Oh, and the TV newscaster is men coming in through all hours of the night. And, you know, it's very salacious. Mm. And I thought, that's very 90s appropriate too. It's like hard copy days.
Right, you know? Right. Thank you for saying that because someone else made a comment that, they didn't say they wouldn't dox her like that, but that's kind of what they were getting at. I'm like, oh, yes, they would.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
How
I was
about
there,
that name,
I remember.
Candy Watson? I just felt like that is the perfect name for that kind of vigilante reporter.
The characters in this book are very well drawn, and you definitely. When you see one of them walk into the room, when you read one of them walking into the room, okay, here we go. This is going to be entertaining.
But you can see them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you can in your mind. And Jessica, in my mind, looks like somebody I knew years ago. And
she definitely looks like someone that I knew as well. I have a person in mind for her.
Oh, yeah, I think I do too. And I guess that's how you do it. So The Critic is out now.
Yeah.
Available in fine bookstores near you.
Yes, you can get it at, Pages and Perks. They do a lot of pop-ups.
Yeah.
But also you can get it at Tombolo, Book and Bottle, The Book Lounge, Gilded Page Bookstore, Sunshine Book Company. Those are just a few that are coming to the top of my head. You know, it's interesting. I'm doing an event at St. Leo University in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching a class. And I thought, well, I'm going to want to have some hangout time for downtime. And there are no bookstores around there. There's like this big patch. It's just empty.
Well, there's a great one in Tarpon Springs.
But that's the Gilded Page. The St. Leo is far into the middle.
Is it? Oh, of course it is.
It's near.
I don't have a Google map up here. In my very tiny brain. So, but yeah.
Well, right. Neither do I. But I was just looking at it this morning and thinking, why isn't there a bookstore right here?
You told me once that you didn't consider yourself a memoirist; that you consider yourself a writer, and that I think you said something along the lines of writing, you know, fiction. Why is that? I mean, you've been writing all your life, but did you get to this point of like, this is much more fun?
Well, you know, I went into journalism school, and I used to write fictional tales when I was young. I would write plays that I would make my family and friends watch that I enacted with stuffed animals and stick figures. And
you were one of those.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I love to invent stories. I look at things and I think of stories, and that's how my mind works. And, you know, memoir requires a lot of interiority. Mm-hmm. And I prefer to let the reader make decisions about the characters based on their action rather than telling them, which sounds sort of like a basic 101 in writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the difference between sort of exteriority and interiority. And I think that in fiction, I can have a really nice balance of those two things where you've got a lot of plot and you have opportunities for characters to reflect and make sort of those universal statements. And, you know, in this case, this is a woman who learns to trust herself. When all the doors slam shut for her, she has to just dig deep and figure out, okay, I'm going to do it. And I didn't want to have a big monologue about that, so I show it in the book. I show that moment when she drives across the bridge.
Yeah. Yep. She drives across the bridge, folks. And
Pittsburgh is the city of bridges.
And then the dream doesn't come back. You got to read the book to find out what that means. But let's talk briefly about the Queenpin Chronicles, because I remember you telling me after Florida Girls was the first one, and I remember you telling me that it really was kind of just intended to be a standalone book, but the characters kept talking to you.
Yes, that's very true.
We want to do more. And then you ended up doing it was an amazing adventure of how she goes from here to here to here, and things change, and organized crime is involved, and it's a whole thing. It would make a great Netflix should pay attention to this. Are you listening?
Netflix, hello.
This story ends. I mean,
this story definitely ends. So this is part of a new series, because I think that Pittsburgh in the 90s was a very interesting place because it was on the verge of this gentrification happening.
Yeah.
And so you've got this mix of – there's some real old money in Pittsburgh, but then there is sort of this new influx coming in. And now, you know, Google is not far from where I had purchased a rundown old house that I – remodeled a long, long time ago.
There's a lot of that in the book, too, when they're going to visit, look for, what's his name, at Ted's house.
Oh, yeah, in Bloomfield.
In Bloomfield.
Well, Bloomfield has kind of stayed the same, interestingly.
Well, there's a lot of narrative about the way the neighborhoods look.
Yeah.
And the gentrification, or non, as it were, depending on where we are, which I thought, it felt very much like, those passages felt like, yes, you had
lived experience.
Lived experience. There you go.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. But I think that those are interesting times to write in. It's the same way that this was kind of the dawn of the internet and forensics were differently developed, we'll say. The reason that it was feasible that they would have even known that Ted had ricin poisoning was because he was the one who suggested it, which is immediately suspicious.
We're not giving anything away here, folks. So look, actually we're out of time, but
let me finish saying though, the Steel City Mysteries are going to be standalones.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
Steel City Mysteries. Does it say that on the front of the book?
It does.
Oh, see, there's the cover. It's sitting on the table here, folks. I didn't realize that. Tell me more.
Well, so they'll all be psychological suspense in nature, and I have them planned out sort of to progress through the 90s. At the end, I'll pull it all together with a narrative that kind of gives some closure. But I know myself, and I know what I'm getting into writing in each of these books.
Yeah.
And I have ideas that I want to explore with this series, and then on to the next thing.
How fast do you write?
Well, I can write pretty quickly, and I like to chunk out a vomit draft as quickly as possible. But then editing takes me, it can take me a long time. Mm-hmm. So I am almost finished with the second book. It's called The Heist, and it is about theft at an art museum. I thought of this book concept long before the thing happened at the Louvre, and I thought, oh, I probably should have led with this book. But and I actually ended up doing a major edit on this book, which is why everything sort of got pushed back, why I only have a print copy for you right now. And so I had to put the heist down completely. Mm. And then, of course, around launch, there are so many details to attend to, plus, yep. of course, life. And
yeah, that's true. That does happen.
Yeah. And so I ended up just picking it back up, and hopefully that will be out in November.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
And best of luck with this book, and we'll see you when the heist is happening.
See you next time.